global gun culture today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. America loves its guns.
We have almost double the firearm ownership rate of any other country.
But we're not alone in suffering from gun violence. We'll hear from a mass shooting survivor in Norway.
Finding a feeling of safety after that has been difficult.
Also, how guns have always played a part in the life of one Salvadoran woman.
My mother taught me how to use firearms at the age of 6.
Plus, how do we respond to gun violence? Thoughts and prayers or gun control legislation?
If we don't address the root problem, which is the evil nature of humanity, then we're not going to solve the problem.
Faith leaders chime in. Global perspectives on guns and gun violence coming up on a special edition of The World. I'm Marco Werman, and we've got a special edition of The World this Friday, Guns Around the Globe. Gun violence happens every day in the U.S., and among industrialized countries, we have the highest rate of gun deaths per year, more than 30,000. But every time there's another mass shooting, we recoil and wonder, how can this happen? How can this be? What can we do about it? So today on the show, we want to stop and give this very American story of guns some global consideration. How does the rest of the world think about guns? We'll hear from countries where guns are seemingly everywhere, like El Salvador.
You go to McDonald's, there's somebody with a gun, you know, walking down the street. You go to the beach, and it's like, really, you know, you're wearing trunks. What's the deal? Why do you need a gun out here on the sand?
But also from Norway, where mass shootings are rare. A survivor of a brutal one has since struggled to understand why it happened.
It was really difficult to deal with the fact that someone coming out of my community wanted to kill me for essentially being me.
What we want to do this hour is look at gun violence from many different points of view, both inside and outside U.S. borders. And our starting point is America, because to be blunt, we're the ones with the biggest problem with gun violence. The World's data team found a way to illustrate that for radio, and that's where we start today with The World's Sophie Chow.
I took all the data about mass shootings in the U.S., and then I translated that to sound. So every time you hear a piano note, that's another mass shooting. It's crazy. If you look at a list of mass shootings, and just for 2017, there are 13 pages of mass shootings. And they start from January 1st, and they go all the way up until yesterday. So almost every day. This starts from January 1st. Dallas, one person died. Fontana, three people died. Fort Lauderdale, five people died. Pasadena, two people died. Flint, one person died. Chicago, one person died. Newark, one person died. Kansas City, three people died. Magnolia, one person died. Capulin, three people died. Sometimes you'll hear that the note is softer, and sometimes it's louder. When it's louder, that means that more people died. This one, Las Vegas. 59 people died. So now when I read about a mass shooting in the news, like the one that just happened in California, I can hear the notes of all the shootings that I'm not reading about every day.
Wow, what an impact when you hear the data like that. A big thanks to The World's Sophie Chow. By the way, the last few notes we heard near the end, they represent the most recent shootings, including the one at the church in Sutherland Springs, Texas, and the one Sophie mentioned in Northern California. If you want to give that data sonification a listen again without narration and hear more about how our data team created it, just go to PRI.org. The numbers are so staggering that sometimes they seem to blur the actual events themselves. But here's a story that will refocus us. You probably remember it. In 2011, Anders Breivik went to a beautiful place to carry out his mass shooting, a summer camp for Labour Party youth on the Norwegian island of Utøya. Breivik was a neo-Nazi nationalist, and on that rainy July morning, he methodically slaughtered 69 people, many of them kids. Among the campers was 20-year-old Bjorn Eiler. After he emerged from his tent, he saw a man with a rifle on a hilltop. Then the shooting began. Eiler ran into the woods where he found two boys, 8 and 9 years old, also hiding. He comforted them, and then all three made their way to the southern tip of the island where they could see a helicopter and boats heading toward them.
We thought we were safe. Then out of the woods behind us came Breivik, and he presented himself as a police officer. He was wearing a police uniform, and then he started shooting at our group. And the kids and I jumped in the water. I kind of swam straight outwards and sank, so dodged his bullets somehow that way, and then stood up again in the water and looked back towards land where I saw Breivik take aim at me.
He was taking aim at you?
Yeah. Yeah.
When he started shooting at your group, was anybody hurt? Was anybody hit?
Oh, people were hit and hurt and killed right there.
Right around you?
Yeah.
So you took those two kids that you found in the woods and you went into the lake to try and get away?
Yeah. After Breivik kind of fired at me, I managed to get the kids around some rocks, and we hid in the water underneath some bushes that were hanging out over the lake until Breivik went up onto the island again and got captured by the real police.
How did the whole standoff end? When did you know that you were fairly safe?
We crawled out of the lake and onto some rocks after a while of not hearing any gunshots, because up until Breivik got captured, we'd heard gunshots every few seconds. While we were on the rocks, a guy in the police uniform showed up from the woods again. This time it was luckily a real police officer, but we had trouble believing that. He managed to convince us that he was not going to shoot us. That's kind of when we were told that we were safe. And then kind of finding a feeling of safety after that has been difficult.
Since that mass shooting in 2011, you've reached out to a lot of reformed extremists on all sides of the political spectrum, neo-Nazis, Muslim extremists, and you've formed bonds and friendships with some of them. What do all these men have in common?
Extremist groups prey on people who have fallen outside of communities somehow, and so they seek out weak individuals who are not feeling they are being seen and heard by the community at large or the community surrounding them. They give them a room, they give them a space, they give them a sense of family.
And you focus on these extremists because after the shooting, you felt that they would be the most likely kind of exponents of gun violence.
Well, after the shooting, I felt a need to understand Breivik, and I felt a need to understand how someone who grew up in my neighborhood, in my city, became like Breivik, because he was so radically different from me. He wanted to kill me and my friends out of some sense of wanting to protect what his identity was. And as I saw it, we didn't pose any threat to him or to his identity. It was really difficult to deal with the fact that someone coming out of my community wanted to kill me for essentially being me.
What should we do then with that knowledge? Is there a way it can be used to stop mass shootings? Like, what would you suggest to us here in the U.S.?
So my suggestion is to make sure that people are relatively happy and healthy. I mean, in the U.S., there's massive problems with social inequality. There's massive problems with the educational system and with the healthcare system, especially when it comes to mental health as well. And I think focusing on those questions and building stronger infrastructure to take care of people and make sure that people feel that they are valued members of society makes them not feel that they have to go to the lengths of shooting up places.
Yeah, but if there are still millions of guns, like in this country, will happy and healthy cut it?
I think happy and healthy will get you a lot further than where you are right now. There is a lot of value in restricting who can buy guns and so forth. But I also think it's unrealistic at this point to completely ban guns in the U.S. There is such a strong culture around gun ownership.
On the beach that day, as Breivik was shooting, he took aim at one of the boys that you found in the woods, and that boy pleaded for his life. What happened?
Breivik decided not to shoot the boy. He said later in court that was because he thought the boy was too young to have been indoctrinated by the policies of the Labour Party and the ideology of the Labour Party.
What does it mean that a man on a murder spree, so intent on killing so many people, spared this one young person?
Breivik wanted to kill me and my comrades because we were who we were and we believed in what we believed in, and we thought that Norway wasn't going to end if we had immigration and so forth. that has been playing a large role in my life and trying to figure out kind of what that ideology looks like, the ideology that drives someone like Breivik, but also what other forms of violent extremist ideologies look like. The denial of diversity and saying that we need to be pure of some sort, that is a recurring theme within all extremist ideologies. We need to kill those people who disagree with us, who live differently than us, who have a different identity from us. Those things have kind of resonated through my work, try to understand how ideologies shape identity and how we can create stronger positive identities rather than destructive identities like Breivik's.
Bjørn Eiler survived the 2011 massacre on the Norwegian island of Utøya. Bjørn, thanks very much for being with us and for speaking again about that day.
Thank you very much.
Here in the States, the right to keep and bear arms is protected by the Constitution. It's right there in the Second Amendment. So we were curious how many other countries talk about weapons in their constitutions.
Well, it turns out very few, actually.
That's Zachary Elkins, Associate Professor of Government at the University of Texas, Austin. Elkins is a director of the Comparative Constitutions Project, and he says the number of those that mention guns has gone down over time.
Early on in the 1800s, there were a fair number of countries, mostly in Latin America, but also Liberia, which, of course, is a country founded by former U.S. slaves. A fair number of those had some right to at least keep, if not to bear arms. I think it reached a high watermark in 1875 or so when we had 9 or 10 constitutions with such a right. But since then, it's become rather extinct. There really are only 3 countries, the U.S. included, that has something of a right to bear arms. It's Guatemala, Mexico, and the United States.
And in those constitutions in those Latin American countries, how unfettered was that right to bear arms?
Well, in the early days, it looked very much like ours. There was often a clause that expressed the rationale for the right. So in our case, it was to provide for some sort of collective defense in the face of tyranny. And that was repeated in Latin American constitutions. And it also repeated sort of the 2 components of this right, which is both to keep and to bear arms. And most people would interpret that as keep being the right to have it in your residence and bear being the right to have it outside your residence. Mm. And so initially they had both of those components, but over the years they scrapped the bear part. And for the most part, anything that was left in those constitutions of the 1900s had only referred to the right to keep arms in your residence.
So is this kind of the trend over time? Nations that have had constitutional provisions on the right to bear arms rescinded them later?
That's right. I mean, I think the original rationale for the right, which made sense for some Latin American countries in the 1800s, of course, inspired by the U.S., I mean, that rationale for some sort of collective defense against tyranny just doesn't make sense to a lot of people now. Of course, many people see it as a public health risk, but also there's a growing sense that they're more content with the state having a monopoly over guns and a monopoly over violence.
So as a constitutional expert, can the Second Amendment be amended?
I think there's a lot of room for consensus on the rewriting of the Second Amendment. First of all, I think it makes sense to do so. I mean, this was drafted 200 years ago, and I think if you sat James Madison down in a Boeing 787 with an iPhone and allowed him to FaceTime with Thomas Jefferson, he'd be a little disappointed that we haven't done better with what they've written. But I think
that's
there's
a great
lot of
image, by the way.
It is, yeah. I think there's a lot of latent consensus on what we should do about guns. I think at this point there's emerged something of a consensus that there is an individual right to bear arms. I think people understand that there's some legitimate reasons for people to own arms, whether it be for hunting or defense. And so I think any sense that we're going to prohibit guns, that has long since left the station. But I think that it's also the case that people recognize that there is a very serious public health risk and that it does make sense to have some regulations. And I think we can write the Second Amendment in a way that makes sense.
Zachary Elkins, Associate Professor of Government at UT Austin, thanks very much for your thoughts.
My pleasure. Great to be here.
Later on the show, we'll hear about the origins of the Second Amendment. Next up, though, growing up in El Salvador and the U.S. surrounded by guns. It's all part of this special edition of The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World.
My mother taught me how to use firearms at the age of 6. I distinctly have a memory of us being in the backyard of our house, and she brought a 22 caliber rifle. And she knelt down and she put it in my little arms and she wrapped her arms around me and held my arms as she taught me how to shoot it.
Susan Cruz with a story from her childhood in El Salvador. Her extended family served in the country's armed forces, and she says there were always lots of sidearms in the house. Still, her first experience shooting a gun stands out for her.
I mean, think about it. I'm a middle-aged woman, and I have a very clear memory of feeling both that shock and amazement and the adrenaline rushing, you know, that power of something, you know, that didn't look like much to me at the age of six, but I still remember the feeling. Mm. The message that my mother gave me that day was that guns are only to be used if and when they're absolutely necessary to defend yourself. And I remember that lesson because I grew up around guns. My mother had them in the house. She was an excellent markswoman, as were all the people around me, basically. But I never saw them as something to be trivialized or to be abused.
Was there an unstated message from your mother that maybe you are probably going to use guns again?
Yes, absolutely. You have to remember, El Salvador is not very kind to girls, women, the LGBTQ population, and they are generally treated as professional victims. And so I remember my mother telling me things like how I could equalize my place in the world, mainly, you know, through education. But she also insisted that I needed to protect myself because chances were I was going to need to.
2 years later, when you were eight, you and your mother fled El Salvador. That was 1978, and that's when a civil war was brewing there, and guns were not hard to find in El Salvador, were they?
They've never been hard to find. As a matter of fact, I think it's probably easier to get a gun in El Salvador for as long as I can remember than it is to get an education.
In the U.S., you weren't exactly able to distance yourself from guns. By the time you were a teenager, you were in a transnational gang. You lost a lot of friends to guns and violence in the 80s. Have you ever counted, like, how many young people that you knew well were killed in gang violence in the Los Angeles area in the 80s?
I actually had a very good friend commit suicide in front of us in 1991. He had been a child soldier in El Salvador and had both mental health and substance abuse issues, and he took a 380 and pointed it to his head and shot himself in front of us on a Friday in December.
Wow,
so
that's intense.
Would say, yes, it is very intense. And I myself, you know, have come, you know, to wonder sometimes, well, would I feel safer if I had a gun? And I'll be honest with you, it has been quite of a torturous decision-making process for me. But given what I've seen, I wouldn't want that. And people are more likely to be hurt with their own guns, either by their own hand or because somebody comes in and tries to steal it and hurts them with it. So not everyone should have easy access to weapons.
You've been in and out of the States since the 1980s. You did go back to El Salvador for a while, but now back here. I mean, what's it like? What's it been like for you to witness American gun culture?
When the war ended in 1992, I went back in 1993, and I was actually employed by a U.S.-based importer who represents Smith & Wesson, Winchester Olin, Colt, Browning, among other products and services that are manufactured in the United States that mainly cater to the military and to the police.
Can I ask you why you got a job with them?
Well, I moved back to El Salvador hoping to start fresh, you know, open up a brand new chapter in my life after having been involved in the gang, you know, in California. So I applied for this job. I had very special skills. You know, I was young. I knew how to use a computer. My main task was to translate the technical specifications of all the products and services that this firm offered into Spanish. And I was probably the one that knew what we sold the best, besides, you know, the president of the company. For example, we were the first ones to sell the police their official sidearm, basically providing the guns for all the police in the country and the ammunition. Some of the other major customers that we had was private security firms.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's funny. I often hear people complaining about open carry, going to Starbucks, and there's, you know, a bunch of people
really go to
with
Latin
guns
America.
Out. Exactly. You can't go anywhere. I mean, you can't turn your nose without running into somebody with a gun. You go to McDonald's, there's somebody with a gun. You go to the beach and it's like, really, you know, you're wearing trunks. What's the deal? Why do you need a gun out here on the sand? It's a sum-zero mentality. They will take down anything or anyone that they perceive as a threat. It's interesting, you know, because I often tell people, you know, when trying to explain gangs, the phenomena of gangs and gang behavior, they also tend to think like that. They tend to think that being armed, you know, they will protect themselves. If they've been hurt, they even have more reason to validate having a gun. When I was younger, back then, I really did subscribe to the idea that I needed to protect myself, that I was at a disadvantage because of my gender, because of my youth. I was at a disadvantage and I needed to be able to supplement my sense of safety by having a gun on me. And the parallels between folks that are, you know, say on the legal side of, you know, state-sponsored security and those that are on the opposite end, they have very similar mentalities.
So you've been, Susan, on the manufacturing end and on the user end, and now you're working with troubled kids on both sides of the border. How much are guns a major disruptor in their lives today?
When someone is scared and paranoid, there is no way that you can talk them out of putting down a gun. Between me telling them that they'll be safer without a gun and them putting down the gun and feeling naked, as someone put it, and feeling vulnerable, it's an extension of masculinity, you know, for some youth. And for young women, it's a way, as my mother put it, to try to level the playing field.
The conversations after a mass shooting in this country have become fairly predictable and don't seem to last terribly long. When there is a mass shooting in the U.S., what do you want Americans to understand? Give us the El Salvador view.
I want Americans to understand, you know, that at the rate this country is going, they're going to be just, if they're not already, as desensitized as we are in El Salvador about homicides. It's wave after wave after wave of one tragedy after another, and people do get desensitized to it. And they just don't want to deal with it anymore. They don't want to talk about it anymore because they feel helpless. And I disagree because I think that there is a lot that we can do. There are things that these mass shooters have in common. They have histories of violence, particularly domestic violence. Mm-hmm. And it's very easy to hurt other people that you don't know and you don't love them when you've already crossed the line of hurting those that are closest to you and those that you love. So I think, you know, taking things like intrafamily violence, domestic violence, child abuse, animal abuse, taking these things very seriously, this is, you know, where you get to the root of it.
Salvadoran American Susan Cruz founded Sin Fronteras, a nonprofit that helps young immigrants in conflict with the law build new lives. Susan, it is always great to speak with you and hear your stories. Thank you.
Thank you, Marco.
I'm Marco Werman. Want to know why America has a worse problem with mass shootings than any other nation? Just look at the data.
It's not that we have higher homicide rates. It's not about suicide rates. The difference between us and other countries was firearms per capita.
America's gun problem, the global perspective. That's just ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to a special edition of The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. All this hour on The World, we're focusing on guns and gun culture around the globe. America has a big problem with mass shootings and gun violence in general, as we heard in the first half of the show. But America isn't the only place where people love their guns. Number two on the list of nations with most guns per capita is Yemen. Very different context, of course, but like here, it's pretty easy to get a gun in Yemen. There are gun markets everywhere. So who's buying?
The short answer is pretty much anybody. You know, if you have the money in Yemen, you can pretty much get whatever you want at the gun market.
More on Yemen and its gun culture in just a few minutes. Also coming up are thoughts and prayers, what people from different faith communities say about the way we respond to gun violence. First, though, let's find out more about where the U.S. sits in the global ranking when it comes to guns. Criminologist Adam Langford published a paper last year about mass shooters. The idea was that we could use statistics to understand the problem. Langford wanted to find out if it's true that the U.S. has more mass shootings per capita than any other country, and if it is true, then why? He wanted an apples-to-apples comparison among 171 countries, and that meant Langford had to come up with just the right criteria that would narrowly define a mass shooter.
Really, we're just looking at one form of criminal behavior, and I classify it the same way in all countries. In this case, I was looking at public mass shooters. These were individuals who attacked in public using firearms, killing not only maybe someone they had a grudge against, but also bystanders. And I was looking specifically at individuals who killed four or more victims as kind of a baseline threshold. So that was studying that in all sorts of countries: school shootings, workplace shootings, theater shootings, church shootings, mosque shootings. I'm not counting, for example, organizational acts of terrorism or genocide. So like violence committed in Rwanda or in Bosnia by a group of people with firearms who are exterminating the population. That kind of thing wouldn't count.
So this is in 171 countries. How many mass shootings did you actually look at?
Over the entire span, I found 292 qualifying offenders.
Right. And this is in a period of time from the 60s through quite recently, right?
Yes. And people may be familiar with kind of a infamous 1966 University of Texas tower shooting.
In Austin. Right.
And that kind of began this modern phase of these types of crimes. And so that was the starting point for the study.
So what was your conclusion from conducting the study?
Well, overall, I found that the United States is indeed the leader in terms of having the most public mass shooters. We had 31% of these offenders, despite the fact that we only have about 5% of the world's population. So we have well more than our share. And of course, that's very concerning for a variety of reasons. But you can also think about this in terms of other big countries, right? China and India would be two clear examples, and yet they don't have anywhere near the public mass shooter problem that we do.
And what about the possession of guns? Where does the U.S. rank?
Right. So in terms of answering that second question, which is really why do we have more of these types of attacks than other countries, the clear answer, applying statistical models to data from all these 171 countries, was it's not that we have higher homicide rates. It's not about urbanization. It's not about suicide rates. The difference between us and other countries was firearm ownership rate. In other words, firearms per capita. We have almost double the firearm ownership rate of any other country.
Wow. What barriers were there in getting the data? I mean, like for starters, I would think language you don't understand would be one.
You might be surprised, or perhaps not, that these incidents in other countries are so rare and so impactful in those countries that they're often actually covered by the American media. So I did find American media coverage of cases all around the world. Sometimes they actually appear in military reports. For example, a mass shooting in Yemen may be an incident that is reported in military news as kind of an indication of something that was important in that country. And then I also looked at national media from these various countries. So their own newspapers, their own news sources, where this thing would be reported just like it is here.
So you took a scientific approach to this. Do you have a scientific answer about what to do about these mass shootings and more generally an approach to better control of firearms in the U.S.?
Well, the scientific answer would be reduce the number of firearms in the country and reduce firearms availability. You know, we can look at other countries and say, well, what makes us different from them? And when it comes to this particular problem, we'd like to be more like them. You know, Australia is one example. They had a horrible mass shooting there a number of years ago, and they did enact better gun control. They engaged in a gun buyback program that reduced the number of firearms in their country by 20%. And they have seen major dividends in terms of fewer mass shootings in that country.
Adam Langford, thanks very much for your time.
Sure. Thank you.
Adam's a criminologist at the University of Alabama. You can find his paper and a story about Australia's gun buyback program at PRI.org. Okay, back to Yemen now, which, as I mentioned, is second only to the United States in terms of guns per capita. These days, there's a war raging in Yemen, but many of the country's guns were there before the war. We asked journalist Teak Root to explain why that is. He lived in Yemen before its collapse into civil war and has written about Yemen's gun culture. So, Teak, I gather a lot of this you can trace to Yemen's history on trade routes and the bazaars for goods of all sorts, guns just being one of them. Can you tell us about visiting a gun market in 2013? This was in a city you went to called Jahana, and you were researching an article. Give us a tour of what you saw.
Yeah, so I went to this gun market with a friend of mine who happened to be a government employee and also have a tribal status. And so we had to go through multiple government checkpoints to get there. The street looks like a normal market in a lot of ways, but the majority of the shops are selling firearms, everything from pistols to automatic weapons to RPGs. I saw tank shells, and I'm told if you ask the right person, you could get a tank itself.
Wow. So who's buying this stuff?
The short answer is pretty much anybody. You know, if you have the money in Yemen, you can get whatever you want at the gun market. A lot of people use it for day-to-day protection. I know wealthier members of tribes often have bodyguards, and so they'll all be armed, usually with Kalashnikovs.
So you say anybody can buy these, but again, you qualify that with anybody with money. If everybody wanted to, would they have a gun in Yemen? I just want you to give us a sense of the culture of gun ownership.
In Yemen, it's just everywhere, everywhere from security to weddings. I mean, wedding celebrations, people will let off some gunfire for that. I know during the Arab Spring, there were a couple nights of celebration where the skies of Sana'a were red with gunfire, and, you know, the bullets have to land somewhere, which is always a problem.
Drill down a little deeper on that, because I know weapons are rife in the Mideast, but they mean different things to different people, like tool of war, tool of protection, a valuable possession that, as you say, you might shoot in the air for a celebration at a wedding. For Yemenis, what do weapons mean?
I would say all of the above. It's definitely a tool of culture. It's a tool of status, right? If you can afford a gun, that does mean something. I think a lot of people do see it as vital to their security as well. A lot of people make a lot of money off guns in Yemen. A lot of people in political power in the country are in the weapons trade, but also all the way down to soldiers. I met a soldier once in Yemen who was guarding a checkpoint, and when I went over and talked to him about what he was doing, he mentioned that he had actually sold all the bullets out of his gun to have some spending money while he was there.
Wow.
It really means a lot to a lot of people in Yemen, from economics to culture to security.
How responsible are gun owners in Yemen once they come into possession of any of these firearms?
I think it varies widely. Some people are very good with their guns and they handle them very well, but I think there are some other people who maybe aren't. I remember one time I was having lunch at a friend's house, and there was a maybe 3, 4, 5-year-old there playing with a Kalashnikov, and the magazine was out of the gun, and the little kid was trying to put the magazine in the gun, but was trying to put it in backwards. And I remember the dad reaching over, and I thought to myself, great, he's going to take this gun in this magazine away from this child. And he took the magazine and flipped it around and put it in the right way, showing the kid how to do it the correct way. And then the kid was sort of waving this Kalashnikov around for a little bit of the meal.
Wow. How old did you say that kid was?
Must have been maybe 4, 5 tops. So I think there are people who are responsible with their guns, but I think there are some people who just don't know how to use them. And I think the Yemeni army is an interesting example of that, because they don't go through much training and each of them get issued an automatic weapon. And so it is a situation rife with mistakes.
Have you ever heard of someone staging a mass shooting in Yemen that wasn't a military assault?
Not in the way that we have mass shootings in the U.S. The shootings that happen seem to have more relation to either a tribal conflict or an ongoing dispute with somebody. The shootings that I heard about or saw in Yemen usually had maybe more of an explanation than they do in the U.S. You didn't hear the mental health argument as much. There would usually be a clear reason why somebody had used their gun.
Journalist Teak Root lived in Yemen, now back in the States. Thanks very much, Teak, for your thoughts on this.
Thank you, Marco.
Firearms are often thought of as a guy thing, but plenty of women also shoot guns. Our next story is about two sisters. One likes guns, the other not so much. Here's the world's Lydia Jean Cott, and a heads up, her story does include the sound of gunfire.
Continue on Massachusetts 120.
I'm in Lydia Emanuelidou's car. She's my friend and coworker here at The World, and we're driving through the rain to a gun range. Lydia's older sister, Jen, has been begging her to go shooting with her for years.
One year she asked me to go with her as her birthday present, and I refused.
But now, in part because we're doing this special show all about guns, Lydia's finally agreed to go. Lydia and her sister Jen are pretty close, but they're also pretty different.
Do you think that there's a chance that you coming to do this, like, will make you guys closer?
It's possible. I would imagine she's very happy about it because she's been trying to get me to go for a long time, and I can't think of anything that I've asked her to do so many times that she hasn't done, so it is kind of selfish on my end.
Lydia just doesn't get why her sister likes guns. Growing up, guns weren't really part of their lives. Her family immigrated from Greece when she was about 12, her sister about 15. Greece has pretty strict gun laws. It's not common to own one unless you're a police officer or in the military. But when they moved to the U.S., Jen got into gun culture. It was about 6 years ago when she got a Groupon for a trip to the shooting range. Lydia finds this development weird and confusing. Part of it might be that she doesn't like loud noises, like those toilets on airplanes.
In airplanes, flushing is, like, a huge problem for me. Like, I have to, like, plug my ears and flush with my, like,
really?
You know.
Like,
yeah, because I just, it really upsets me. Really loud, sudden noises really upset.
Have you always had that?
With some things, yeah. Yeah.
A gun range seems to be the worst possible place for you.
Yep.
Hi, Jen. Nice to meet you.
I'm Lydia Jean Cott. Are you
Lydia's sister?
Yes, I am.
Jen's hair is long and highlighted. Lydia's is short and dark. Jen wears makeup. Lydia's look is natural. But they have the same eyebrows, eyes. They're clearly sisters. We go into a classroom at the gun place to get a quick tutorial about how to shoot. Jen seems so happy and proud that her younger sister finally came.
I'm very excited. I come to the range very often, and I'm excited to show her, you know, how much fun it can be.
Our instructor is actually Jen's friend, Stav Avramidis. I asked Stav about how she got into guns.
My oldest sister, who's 10 years older than me, took me. Then it just became like a huge passion for me, and ever since then, I'm here all the time.
Could the same thing happen to Lydia?
Okay, so these are the glasses, and then those are the muffs.
We open a heavy door and enter the gun range. Every time a gunshot goes off, Lydia flinches. But then she gets used to the sound, and our instructor, Stav, hands her a .22 caliber revolver.
So with a revolver, you're going to grip it with your right hand.
Lydia takes aim, and then turns around to look at us. And accidentally points her revolver at us as well.
I'm sorry.
Despite this mishap, Lydia seems exhilarated. And it turns out she's a natural. Most of the time, she hits the bullseye. We go back into our classroom for a kind of post-game meeting.
I am not crazy about the loud noises.
This is Lydia.
And the danger I might put others in, as we saw, by accident. But it was okay.
For Jen, guns aren't just a hobby. She owns a gun because she feels like having one keeps her safer.
You know, if I could make it so that there are no guns in this world that kill people, or that there is no alcohol in this world that kills people, or no cars in this world that kill people, of course, you know, I would have it that way. But because we live in the world that we live in, I find it necessary to own a firearm because you never know.
On our car ride back, I ask Lydia whether she understands why her sister likes guns a little better now.
I try to think about, like, how I'm like that in other ways. You know, like, when I feel a cold coming on, I'm the psycho that goes and gets tons and tons of vitamin C supplements and zinc. And, like, I have this weird thing where I take a shot of alcohol. That's, you know, the equivalent of being overly prepared, I think. Not equating that to gun culture.
But yeah, no, I get, like, more like
other situations.
So,
yeah.
Like, you and your sister. Like, something you share with your sister.
Yeah.
She says that next year, if her sister asked her to go to the gun range for her birthday, she'll probably say yes. For The World, I'm Lydia Jean Cott.
I'm Marco Werman with The World. One question we always try to ask on the show is, how did we get here? That's where our resident history guy, Chris Wolf, comes into the picture. So let's talk about how we got here with the Second Amendment. It states, very simply, Chris, that a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms, shall not be infringed. Why was this language so important to the founders?
Marco, the roots of the Second Amendment lie in English law, the revolutionary experience itself, and contemporary European political thought. In short, it's the idea that the people have a right to defend themselves against tyranny, and that if a government breaches that social contract with its people, the people have a right to overthrow that government. It's the argument that lies at the very heart of the Declaration of Independence, Marco. So it's almost like you can't have the ideology of the Declaration of Independence without the Second Amendment.
So this kind of springs out of the Enlightenment. Can you describe the roots of that fear of tyranny in the 18th century?
Well, it was a very real fear. You think about the mindset of the colonists. They had seen this in the case of France in the 1680s when disarmed French Protestants were forced to convert to Catholicism at the muzzle of the barrels of the guns of the king's dragoons. And in England itself, a pro-Catholic king, James II, attempted to disarm Protestants again with an idea, probably false, that he was going to forcibly convert them to Catholicism. We never found out because he was overthrown in a revolution in England in 1688, which ended in their Bill of Rights being written in 1689 and enshrining the right to bear arms as one of those liberties of freeborn English men.
So if the founders here in America were trying to prevent tyranny, how did that work out in the long run?
Well, obviously, it seems admirable in theory, much more difficult to put into practice. For example, how do you decide who speaks for the people? And the United States itself was not happy when people tried it. They weren't happy when the Confederates tried it. They weren't happy when the Black Panthers talked about it in the 1960s. And they weren't happy when angry farmers in Pennsylvania tried it as early as the 1790s in the Whiskey Rebellion.
Let me just ask you about English law. You mentioned that there was this provision in their Bill of Rights to keep and bear arms. Does that still exist?
Well, in a word, no. England doesn't have a constitution. This was just a law, and Parliament is supreme and can rewrite any law and repeal any law. So with various acts that started as early as 1716, there were attempts to restrict the ownership of weapons and firearms in particular.
So in that phrase in the Second Amendment, you've got the components of today's gun control debate. Gun control activists point to well-regulated, the NRA, and its followers point to shall not be infringed. When did the Second Amendment change to mean an individual's right to bear arms rather than this kind of more collective notion of owning guns?
Well, it is both. In the 2008 Supreme Court decision, the District of Columbia versus Heller, the court finally defined it as meaning both. But if you look at the earliest legal commentaries, the individual's right to defend themselves and the individual's right to bear arms are there alongside this notion of collective defense against tyranny and external threats and even internal threats. So in a sense, America today has to ask itself, does this theoretical need to defend against tyranny outweigh the apparent public health need of the need to reduce gun deaths?
The World's History Guy, Chris Wolf, thank you very much for this. Really interesting.
You're welcome, Marco.
Finally, thoughts and prayers. It's the kind of phrase you see on social media after a mass shooting. A lot of people find that inadequate. So what are religious believers actually saying about gun violence in America? The World's Matthew Bell spoke with a few of them.
Pardeep Kalika of Franklin, Wisconsin, is a gun owner. That makes sense. He's a former police officer. It also squares with his religion. Sikhs, Kalika says, are known for being warriors.
We have a saying in our faith that after you exhaust all other means, it is proper to pick up the sword. And now people have replaced that sword with a gun.
But Kalika thinks about this stuff very differently than he used to. In 2012, a white supremacist went into the Sikh temple where Kalika's family prays on Sundays. 10 people were shot, 6 died. One of them was Kalika's father. Gun violence is a public health crisis, Kalika says, and people need to talk about it with courage and honesty.
My 9-year-old came home a couple days back and told me about an active shooter drill that they're doing at their elementary school. Why are we doing active shooter drills and at elementary schools? Why is that necessary? Altogether, I think we just have way too many guns.
Kalika says he worries that gun violence in America is going to get worse before it gets better. Joe Carter thinks about the whole issue in another way. He's an editor at the Gospel Coalition. Carter says it's no surprise that many conservative evangelicals, like him, are skeptical about the wisdom of rushing to pass new gun control laws after a high-profile mass shooting.
A lot of the gun control measures are in place already. They're just not being enforced. I mean, if you're going to shoot up a church, you're not likely to worry too much about a gun control law. So I think the problem is that many of the laws are already in place, and they're just not as effective as people assume they are.
Carter says he's all for keeping guns out of the hands of criminals, but where he grew up in rural Texas, the idea of going to church with a gun in your truck or your holster was normal. It's the prevalence of evil and sin, Carter says, that many evangelicals see as the real problem here, not just guns.
We keep thinking that if we just pass this one law, gun violence will go away. It's never going to happen. We're never going to eradicate sin, so we're always going to have to deal with these issues. But I think we can do a better job of addressing them at a lower level and at a more personal level.
For example, Carter says many of the shootings at churches are connected with domestic violence. That's something, he says, people need to talk about more. Mara Newman has changed the way she thinks about firearms. She grew up in the New York City area where relatively few people owned guns. Now, as the senior rabbi at Temple Beth El in San Antonio, Texas, Newman says some members of her congregation are ranchers or hunters, and she's pretty sure some of them, when they come to synagogue, bring their gun.
I know that there are people who do, whether they've left it in their car or whether it's in their bag or it's in their cowboy boot. You know, I mean, there certainly are people who are most likely carrying.
And Newman says she respects that, but she still thinks that a big part of the solution to gun violence in America is tougher gun controls. Pardeep Kalika, whose father was killed at the Sikh temple 5 years ago, says there's no agreement on this issue. But people of faith, he says, bring an important perspective.
God exists in every person, regardless of race, gender, creed, caste, class. It exists in everybody. God exists in our compassion and our forgiveness and our ability to like see the soul in another person and say, hey, I need to protect life.
And that's where people of faith, Kalika says, need to step up. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
And whether you're religious or not, you can't deny the need to protect lives. In a way, that's what we really wanted to do with this hour on the show today. By talking about how the world sees guns and all the problems they raise, those conversations can make us wiser and, we hope, safer. Thanks for being with us today and listening. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston. Our theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. I'm Marco Werman, back with you on Monday.
PRI, Public Radio International.